This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Rex Huerman.
Welcome back to our final segment analyzing the Peacock documentary about Rex Huerman. It's called The Gilgo Beach Killer, House of Secrets. You're breaking it down with psychotherapist Siobhan Scott. What you're about to witness is perhaps the most heartbreaking footage yet. In it, Rex Huerman's daughter, Victoria, grappling with the impossible question, can you love someone who just might be a monster? Her journey from denial to acceptance, from blind loyalty to painful questioning, represents what mental health professionals rarely get to see so rawly displayed. The real-time psychological processing of unthinkable trauma. Before we dive into this footage, I need to provide context about Victoria Huerman's journey that makes her words even more poignant. When Rex was arrested in July of 23, Victoria was working at her father's architecture firm. She wasn't just his daughter, she was his protege, following in his professional footsteps, building her career on the foundation he provided. In an instant, she lost not just her father, but her mentor, her employer, her entire professional identity, and personal as well. But the losses go deeper than her career. Victoria went from being the daughter of a respected Manhattan architect to being the daughter of an accused serial killer. Every Google search of her name will forever be linked to the murders. Every job application will require explaining why she left her last position. Every new relationship will eventually lead to the question, wait, Huerman? Like the Huerman? What makes Victoria's perspective so valuable is her age during the murders. As she points out, she was 10, 12, 13 years old when the Gilgo Four were killed. She was doing homework while her father was allegedly hunting women. She was at school while he was allegedly disposing of bodies. This temporal disconnect creates a unique psychological challenge. How do you reconcile childhood memories of a loving father with evidence of horrific crimes? And here's something crucial that wasn't discussed in our segment. Victoria's artwork. Since her father was arrested, she's been creating disturbing pieces that seem to process her trauma. Dark, violent imagery that Rex's former friend described as showing another side of the family dynamics. It's as if her subconscious is working through what her consciousness might be struggling to accept. There's a 90-10 split. She mentions her father being present 90% of the time, but absent that crucial 10%. It's particularly revealing because that 10% wasn't random. It wasn't business trips or golf weekends. It was specifically when the family was away. Every single murder Rex is charged with occurring or committing occurred during that 10%. What child would think to question why daddy encourages family vacations but doesn't join them? Victoria's comment about being on the fence has evolved significantly since this documentary was filmed. By the time of its release, she'd moved from fence sitting to believing her father is most likely guilty. This evolution captured in real time provides invaluable insights into how family members process evidence that contradicts everything they believed about someone they loved. What Siobhan Scott and I explore in this segment is the psychological concept of ambiguous loss, grieving someone who is still alive but no longer the person you thought they were. Victoria isn't just losing her father to prison. She's losing the father she thought she had to the reality of who he might actually be. It's a form of grief that has no roadmap, no cultural rituals, no sympathy cards. Can you imagine going to the store? Go to the Hallmark aisle. Let's see here. There's a shoebox greeting. Sorry, your dad's the Gilgo Beach killer. You're a winner. Thumbs up. We also delve into how predators like Rex don't just victimize those they kill. They create expanding circles of trauma that engulf their own families. Victoria's humiliation, her struggle with public shame for crimes she did not commit. Her desperate need to see evidence before accepting the truth. These are all symptoms of what psychologists call perpetrator-induced trauma in family members. Prepare yourself for raw honesty as Victoria articulates what many family members of accused criminals struggle to voice, that love and hate can coexist, that you can, despite someone's actions, while still carrying love for who they were to you, that accepting someone's guilt doesn't erase your history with them. It's a psychological complexity that challenges our binary level of thinking about good and evil.
The part of, okay, so yeah, me standing my ground and wanting to see the evidence first is, in a way, protecting myself, but it's protecting me. It keeps my head on straight with everything everybody is saying. One person saying this, one person saying that, prosecutor saying this, but my memory says this. So yeah, the fact that I'm standing my ground and I need to see the evidence is keeping my head on straight from all this.
Let's watch one more here of her observations on
maybe
dad.
Even with all this growing evidence against him, maybe there is some loyalty still to my dad and to my mom too. Like, listen, whether the world likes it or not, whether I like it or not, he's my dad. They can't take that away from me. I don't know what acceptance looks like. Acceptance to me is just it. I have to move on. I think if he was guilty, it's gonna start to become like a love-hate relationship. This is my dad, and I love him as my dad. The hate is this other side of him that came out. And going forward, I'm not going to interact with him the same way I would have if this never happened. Both the feelings, love and hate, can coexist.
And that, I think, is a real tough one for a lot of people in that situation to wrap their mind around, that both love and hate can coexist. Can you talk on that for a moment?
It's very, very, very true. And it's hard to understand, because when we think of love, we think of unconditional love, because we hear that term all the time. In truth, people who have abusive or highly disturbed, as in serial killer, highly disturbed parents, they often don't lose the memories of the attachment. Sometimes they do. Sometimes it's spoiled when they find out what went on. But for many, they struggle for a long time with that, all the good memories, because they have good memories. And in many ways, that person contributed to their development in positive ways. And so it's like they have to compartmentalize. And she also strikes me as somebody who's maybe having some therapy, because she's doing a pretty articulate job of talking through the struggle, the inner struggle that she's have making sense of this right now.
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to normalize or accept abuse as being a good thing by any means. But what she talks about in her memories, at least of what she shared, doesn't sound abusive. It sounds like dad was actually playing a role of dad. How would you talk to someone if maybe you've had this situation where a client has this sort of a situation of they're really struggling because part of them, they did have a good relationship. They did have good memories. Yeah. They were not affected by the monster behind the curtain, but they have to square that up with reality. How does one do that? How does one hold on to those good things and still be able to look at that, I know, lend some sort of warmth or fondness because that was their reality at the time, while still accepting over here that, oh my God, look at what this guy actually did? Or can you?
I think it's a slow process, but it's exactly that. It's talking about the good times and validating that that was real for them, but at the same time bringing up, but here's the other side, mm-hmm. so that they can over time start to integrate the truth that this was a terrible person who sometimes did good things mm-hmm. and treated some people well. And so it's just, there's no way to do it quickly, but there's just that constant talking through blending those two things. It's sort of like being in an abusive relationship where you can think of, oh, but, you know, 9 out of 10 days, he's great and he treats me with kindness in all these other ways. But that's not the totality of the person. And, you know, the other piece, it's important to integrate that. So you just keep talking about it. And I think it gets easier for people over time to make sense of that.
That's true. Let's take one more look at another clip about the daughter trying to square up what's going on in her world with dad.
I went from being a normal person contributing to society every day to this laughingstock all over the internet and TV and news.
Victoria! When I was in the middle of the media frenzy, I'll admit, like, I probably felt, like, humiliated. I know I don't have anything to be shameful about, but that's what it felt like, just the bombarding, people's disappointed faces. I didn't really feel like a person. They asked questions, why didn't I see anything? How, you know, how did I not know? I was 10, 12, and 13 years old when these girls were murdered. I was in school, which takes up a good chunk of the day. And then I was home or doing after school activities. And that's exactly how I wouldn't know anything. And now that I actually look back on my childhood, I do find it very hard to believe my dad actually really did all this.
You mentioned that you're on the fence. Tell me, what do you mean? You know, are you on the fence?
Like I said, I saw him at regular times every day. Morning, night, and the vacations that he did join us on. But like I said, at the same time, there was a lot of hours out of the day that I also was not home, including vacations that he did not join us on. And that's exactly what I mean by on the fence. There's like, well, you know, like he was definitely very much around 90% of the time. But then there's that other 10% of the time he was not. I feel like I can't know whether or not he did or didn't because I was not around for it. I was too young to understand.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of trying to square up. I mean, he really did also rob the individuality out of every single one of his family members because now they're just looked at as, what did you know? When did you know it? And if you don't have anything... It's like people are frowning, yeah, because they didn't have anything to really know. Because this guy seemed to really keep it very, very under the radar.
And the other thing that strikes me is, well, he was home, you know, 90% of the time or whatever. He was on the internet, right?
Yeah.
And what we know about serial killers, they spend a lot of time in ugly, dark places on the internet now, typically. Yeah. And he may have been home and he may have been in his study or his den or his hellhole down there, whatever it is, you know, on his computer. And he was entertaining these sadistic fantasies the whole time. And so I hope during the trial, she said she needs to see the evidence. I hope when she sees it, that this allows that, you know, integration of reality to start to happen for her.
Yeah, it's so, yeah, I feel really horrible for her. And I feel horrible for this whole family. And after seeing this doc, it feels like it answered a lot of questions for me. Yes. Not that it matters what my opinion is, but you know, when you're covering and you're looking at it, you want to figure this out. What the hell is going on here? And for a long time, the big question was, how did Asa not know what the hell was going on? It makes sense with the kids, but I think I get it now. I think I get it for everybody. Yeah. I don't think they had any clue.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. And Asa came into the situation with tremendous vulnerabilities. She was submissive. He chose her for those qualities. And it's just... another element of tragedy, not only for the victims of the murders, but for his family. I mean, it's another element of tragedy here.
He chose her for those qualities, and he also destroyed her life because of those qualities for his own sick, whatever the hell he was doing.
Yeah.
Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, thank you so much. What we just witnessed with Victoria Huerman is something profound. It's a young woman publicly processing trauma that most people can't ever imagine. But there's so much more to unpack here that deserves our attention. First, let's address the elephant in the room that Victoria herself raises, the public's insatiable need to believe family members must have known. This isn't just curiosity, it's a psychological defense. If we can convince ourselves that there were obvious signs that family members were complicit or willfully blind, then we can maintain the illusion that we would never miss such signs in our own lives. Victoria's age during the murders, 10 to 13, makes the scrutiny particularly cruel. What exactly should a middle schooler have noticed about her father's extracurricular activities? But here's a darker truth hidden in her 90-10 observation. Rex Heuermann allegedly understood something fundamental about human psychology. We don't notice patterns in absences. We notice what's there, not what isn't. By being a present involved father most of the time, he created a reality where his absences seemed insignificant. This is advanced psychological manipulation, using presence to mask absence. Siobhan's observation about Rex being home but engaged in dark online activities touches on something we didn't fully explore. Digital forensics revealed Rex had hundreds of searches related to the Gilgo Beach victims, their families, and the investigation. Searches conducted while his family was in the same house. He was physically present, but psychologically hunting, maintaining his violent fantasies while helping with homework and watching TV with the family. This dual existence is what makes cases like this so insidious. The concept of integration that Siobhan discusses, blending the good memories with the horrible reality, is a psychological process that can take years or decades or a lifetime to try and process. Victoria is at the beginning of this journey, and her articulation of needing to see evidence isn't denial, it's self-protection. She's essentially saying, I need proof strong enough to override 20 plus years of lived experience. That's not unreasonable, it's human. What's particularly striking is Victoria's awareness of her own limitations. She acknowledges she can't know what happened during that 10% of the time. This isn't the all or nothing thinking we saw with Asa. This is someone trying to think rationally about an irrational situation, to apply logic to something that defies comprehension, to public humiliation Victoria describes becoming a laughingstock online. Reflects our society's cruel tendency to victimize the families of perpetrators. She lost her job, her professional identity, her privacy, her sense of safety in the world, yet strangers demand she answers for crimes committed when she was a child. The secondary victimization often drives family members deeper into denial. If the world is going to punish you anyway, why accept a painful truth? Siobhan's point about Rex choosing Asa for her vulnerabilities extends to the entire family system he created. He didn't just select a submissive wife. He created an environment where questioning was discouraged, where secrets were normalized, and where absences went unexamined. The children were raised in this system, making them psychological victims long before his arrest. If you're out there listening, you might be grappling with your own family secrets, or struggling to reconcile love for someone who has done terrible things. Victoria's journey offers both validation and hope. It's okay to be on the fence. It's okay to need evidence. It's okay to love someone while hating what they've done. These aren't signs of weaknesses or complicity. They're signs of humanity. The tragedy is that Rex Heuermann's alleged crimes created multiple victim categories. There are the seven women whose lives were brutally ended. There are their families living with permanent loss. And then there's his own family, Asa, Victoria, and Christopher, who must somehow rebuild their lives from the wreckage of this deception. They didn't choose this. They didn't contribute to it. Yet they're serving a life sentence of shame, scrutiny, and shattered trust. As this case moves toward trial, Victoria will likely see the evidence she needs to move from on the fence to acceptance. That journey will be agonizing. But as Siobhan noted, she seems to be getting therapy, developing the tools to process her trauma. Her articulation of complex emotions, her ability to hold contradictions, her recognition of these limitations, her own limitations. These are signs of psychological health in the face of overwhelming trauma. The final truth from our analysis today? Evil doesn't announce itself. It doesn't come with a warning label or obvious red flags all the time. Sometimes it looks like a father who's present 90% of the time, who inspires his daughter's career, who throws plates but never hits. The real horror of Rex Heuermann's case isn't just the murders he's accused of. It's how normally he lived the rest of his life. If you found some value in this psychological deep dive, please subscribe for more analysis of true crime through a mental health lens and many others. Hit subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts. If you're on YouTube, hit subscribe there. And please, in the comment section of YouTube, let me know what your thoughts are on this case, Victoria of Asa, of how they're all doing. I'd love to hear your comments. So please do that. I'm Tony Brewski. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. We'll talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.